Good morning, world diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
This is Peter. Always wondering what
I was going to introduce you.
What is it that Ann's going to start the program off today? You know what we forgot the last several weeks? We forgot to say good afternoon to all the listeners in Europe, and we forgot to say happy Monday when people wake up in Australia and start listening to the program.
This is true, especially.
And that's apropos of the person we're going to talk to right next.
Right. Do you want to introduce Chris Smith?
Well, Chris Smith is joining the program. He's actually joining us from the West Coast, where he's here on a swing through the Fancy Food Show, which has just been a great success for him.
I think that people understand where he's from when they hear his accent. I love the Australian accent.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you today, guys?
Good day, Chris.
Good day.
Good day. That's what they say, right?
Good day.
With an apostrophe in just the right place.
Exactly.
It's apropos because, as our listeners probably know, they've got a clue already. Mm-hmm. On the Menu is headed down under next month to have a whole wonderful month in country. So we've been gathering Australian guests so that we can preview the food dining scene out there. So Chris is joining us today to talk a little bit about his company called Valley Produce. But we just discovered something before we came on the air, that he actually started life in the food business as a chef.
As a very young, accomplished chef.
Go ahead and tell us a little bit about that, Chris.
So hello to all listeners. I started the Valley Produce Company quite young, and before then I was a chef.
Made you be a chef, Chris?
I actually started quite young for me. I was actually doing a lot of home economics at school back in Ferntree Gully. It's a little suburb outside Melbourne, and I had a wonderful teacher. Her name was Mrs. Tran, and she saw a little bit of potential in me, and she actually entered me in a cooking competition, and I actually won. And at the time, I was actually thought I was against other students, but I was actually against young apprentice chefs. So I actually got an opportunity. I started working for a wonderful Melbourne chef named Bill Marchetti. He was probably still recognised as one of the best Italian chefs that's ever cooked in Melbourne. And my career was started, so I worked primarily in fine dining and learning my way around the food scene, which is really, really fun. And eventually became a qualified chef, and also I did my pastry chef apprenticeship and qualified in that as well. It's a lot of fun.
Wow.
So you said you were 21 years old. You had three hats from the Melbourne Age, which is like New York Magazine's four stars, I guess.
That's right.
At a place we're actually going to be going to on a trip called Chateau Yering.
That's right. I was working at Adelphi, which is another three-hat restaurant in Melbourne. There, I got wind of a new restaurant opening up in the Yarra Valley, and wonderful. When you go there, you're going to absolutely love it. If any listeners can ever get out to Chateau Yering, it's a beautiful establishment, smack bang in the middle of the Yarra Valley, which is absolutely beautiful. And so I applied and got the position, and I was at Chateau Yering for 2 years. But we built the business up to get three hats in the best country restaurant, and it was quite an achievement for a 21-year-old. I don't think it's ever happened since then, actually.
And so you're sort of a little bit like an Australian Jamie Oliver, maybe, something like that?
Well, actually, I think the press are a little kind. They do compare me to him a little bit.
He's going to be in Melbourne for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Well, we heard a rumour. I haven't seen that confirmed. So
yeah,
I don't know for sure.
Sensational. What Jamie's been able to achieve is fantastic, and not just with cuisine and his TV and media, but also what he's done for kids and education in the UK. So to be said, you kind of like him in the same sentence, he's really quite an honour. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. So,
But then what happened, Chris? You got fed up of being in the kitchen?
Well,
you had a new passion?
I was one of these really lucky chefs. I still am extremely passionate about what I do. If I was cooking in a kitchen now, I'd be absolutely no problems, very, very happy, and nothing wrong with that at all. One thing is, sure, I left the industry at a time where I still loved it, so I still have a very high regard for it. But I actually, at Chateau Yering, there's a wonderful establishment next door called Yering Station Vineyard, and every Sunday, the third Sunday of each month, they have a farmer's market.
Mm.
And all these Yarra Valley producers used to knock on the back door of the kitchen there and say, hello, chef, I've got some lovely fresh asparagus. Hello, chef, I've got some wonderful new venison. All these different producers would knock on the back door. And I got to be really close, and I'm still friends with a lot of these people. And I decided to actually become a producer myself. And the Valley Produce Company's business was started.
Now, when was it started and what do you produce?
Well, I started in November 2000, and I started making a olive oils made from Verdale and Crediola olives, and a little bit of Novembre Blanco olive, which is a creamy, buttery olive. And I actually made an extra virgin, a lemon, and a Chardonnay and Cabernet dressing, which were two signature dressings I used at Shady Erring, and put a little market stall out and made the products in a little rented kitchen, and the rest was history.
You must have a great sense of entrepreneurship to come as far as you've come at such a young age.
Well, I think Chris Smith's got a sort of interesting story. I actually left home quite early, and to sort of defend for myself, I actually started washing carts, and so I rented my little bungalow that I had, and I put myself through school, and I was actually quite an A grade student. I was always, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it well. That's just the way I see life, and actually ended up employing little kids and around the traps. So we actually used to wash around about 250 cars a weekend.
Oh my
quite
goodness.
Amazing. So it was actually quite fun. So I've always had that in me, I guess. But I enjoy business, and I enjoy good customer service, and I enjoy those things of business. And I think that's fundamentally what we do as a company.
Now, you started out with this business just focusing on Australian products for Australians, but then you branched out. When did you start to attack other countries' markets?
Yeah, well, basically, I've always wanted to keep my business niche, so I've really had no interest in supplying the big boys. Although we have a large manufacturing plant now, we supply niche business all over the world. And in 2003, I did a market research trip around the world. I went to America, Europe, Asia, these places, Dubai in the Middle East, and decided that the American market would be fantastic. I was absolutely so impressed with American grocery stores and how they merchandise cheese. It was just a real eye-opener. So with the products that I was already manufacturing, I really believed that I could make an inroads here in the U.S., and so I decided to make it my major export market.
Now, what you said olive oil first, and then cheese is your other great love. What kind of cheeses do you have?
Well, at the moment, I think it's I love Manchego. We can't get Manchego in Australia because of our importation laws.
Really?
Yep, we can't have the unpasteurized.
Yeah, we're supposed to be talking to somebody called Will Steed about that.
Yes, Will Steed. He's a wonderful cheese guru. A wonderful cheese man out of Melbourne. He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And he's been fighting these regulations just
well,
like
we
just
all
like,
have been. I mean,
it's one of those things.
It's bad in the United States, too.
Absolutely. We're all fighting it. I think these wonderful artisanal cheese makers, not just in Australia, it's in Europe, in America. And Manchego is one of my favourites. I tend to OD on that stuff. I absolutely love it. I really like some of the American cheeses, some of the artisanal stuff in California I've really been enjoying. But for me, a really good room temperature breeze, I think that's always going to be the passion. But yeah,
something like King Island, Chris?
Absolutely. I mean, King Island cheeses have got a range of artisanal cheeses now. They're doing very, very well. In fact, a lot of your listeners from the United States will be able to pick up the King Island Roaring Forties Blue, which is probably the cheese with the most American presence.
I mean, we used to live on that. We went to a phase where we had that constantly in the refrigerator.
Brilliant cheeses. They really are gorgeous. There's also another guy who's making some inroads, especially through a distributor down the south. It's Tarago River cheeses, and those cheeses are absolutely ridiculously good. They are beautiful. And the Tarago River Shadows of Blue and Tarago River Brie. Yeah, if you give a listeners look out for that one, that's a real cracker.
Is that tiger like in the animal that escaped from the San Francisco Zoo?
Absolutely. It's okay. Wonderful, mate. When you have it, it's gorgeous. I mean, Shadows of Blue is one of these blues that it's actually very individual. There's no other blue like it.
Oh, good. I look forward to trying that.
It's make sure you get a nice glass of vino, my darling. It's absolutely beautiful.
we have a nice glass of vino with many things. It's entirely appropriate. Now you stayed in the food business. You haven't been tempted to get into the wine business?
No, I'm very passionate about wine. In fact, it would have been about 5 years ago, I actually took some time to actually do a vintage at Yering Station and learn how to make wine. It's something I've always wanted to do, and I do love it, but no, the wine business is, I think, for other fish, but it's one of those things I still enjoy, that's for sure.
You sound very busy, Chris.
I have been very busy, especially I've gained a bit more life balance probably the last year. The first 6 years of business were just go, go, go. Now it's great to be doing consolidation, and particularly just working with retailers, well, independents and retailer chains that just drive the business forward. So it's a very structured plan. I have wonderful sales and brand managers here in the United States, particularly one named Crystal Black Davis. A lot of your consumers will be seeing her in stores, and she's a wonderful professional person. And you get these people on board, and you can make things happen. And especially with production, I have a great team back in Australia. It's actually really run like a family company, so everyone works as a team. It's a real team environment, something I'm very proud of, actually.
Now, tell us the range of products and how people actually find out about where to buy them. This is our obviously retail customer listeners are a large part of our audience, restaurateurs as well.
Yes. And chefs, too, and chefs too.
I think the way to find Village Produce Company is to go down to your next high-end store in New York. You can find it in all the different grocery stores, Minneapolis, London, Bali's down the south. You've got your fresh market and these sort of stores. And the West Coast, wonderful supporters from Bristol Farms, Andronico's, Molly Stone's, Portland Season Market, Market of Choice, and up in Seattle, QC stores. But if anybody is listening and they do want to find the product, just go to Valley Produce Company, all lowercase, all four words.com. And we have a retail database on there as well.
Oh, great.
And,
so it's a store locator that says this is where you can find it. Okay, terrific.
Absolutely.
Well, I felt sure you probably had that. If not, I was going to suggest it. But, of course, you'd be way ahead of the game.
Yeah, I would think, yeah.
So it's you always find it in the deli counter. You can't sort of miss it.
Now, when will you be back? When will you be back in Australia, Chris?
This tour takes me. It's already taken me to New York, and I'm in. I've done LA and San Diego, and I go back to LA for the wonderful G'day USA events in Los Angeles this week.
Oh yes.
And then I go up to San Francisco for what I call the Meet the Maker tour. So I'm doing some retailer promotions there, and then over to New York to go on Good Day New York. And then down to Houston for Good Day Houston, which are breakfast morning shows. And then finalize some tours through the Midwest and up to Seattle. And then I'll probably have to go to London, off to Dubai.
Oh,
and then
that's
home.
Tough.
There you go.
So I'll get home sometime in February, guys.
Great. Well, listen, send us an email and let us know that you've landed back in Australia, because we'll be getting email while we're away, and maybe we can get connected when we're in Melbourne for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Actually, I'll be around when that Food and Wine Festival's on. So,
well, maybe we'll touch.
It'd be wonderful to touch base with you.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Take you out to the factory and take you for a little tour. It's a wonderful little place, and meet all the staff. We've got some of the most funniest staff. All my staff are ex-chefs, and you'll have a good time there.
And what's your favorite restaurant in Melbourne?
I've got a few, but there's one that I always enjoy because of just sheer consistency, and that's Grossi Florentino. It's a Italian restaurant in Bourke Street in the city, and
I've been reading about that. Now, he just took over a place in St Kilda. I was reading.
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
So he sounded like he's quite a controversial character as well.
He's he's one of these out there Italians, and I think he's a champion, Grossi Graham. Guy Grossi, and wonderful man.
That's great.
One of our favorites is Donovan's House.
Absolutely. Gail and Kevin actually, they'd probably be in my top three. That's a wonderful establishment. They run a well-old machine there. And,
yeah, we've been several times.
Wonderful.
So they're
wonderful
again.
People. make sure you let them know you're coming because they're just so wonderful.
No,
we got an email.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Gail.
I exchanged email with Gail for the first time for 5 years. Got an email right back, said I'll be busy on Sunday afternoon, but Sunday morning I can meet you, and so come see us. So we're definitely going to do that.
That's fabulous.
Isn't she the one that did that wonderful book about walking her dog in Italy?
Yes, yeah.
And she
decorates the bar area with bottles of, one year it was Heineken, another year it was Campari, probably something like 500 bottles of Campari. I never did figure out whether they were full or empty.
Well, and for another time, we have a funny story about encountering a letter from her in Sicily. But
yeah. I also just reestablished connection with Philippe Michel.
Oh, he's another genius chef as well.
Yeah,
absolutely brilliant.
We first were at the Paul Bocuse restaurant in the Daimaru Center when it was there.
Mm-hmm. That was wonderful.
Then he went through somewhere else. Now he has his own place and it's Crown Complex.
That's correct.
Which is where everybody seems to have a restaurant.
Except we know we're not going to try to telephone out a radio show because they block overseas calls. That's another story, Chris.
When
we see you, we'll tell you all our foibles.
That was the funniest thing. When we actually tried to do broadcast real time, that was a real challenge. Recording as we're doing now, and recording as we'll be doing in Melbourne, and then bringing the tracks back is a whole lot more convenient.
Yep,
well, listen,
absolutely.
We're delighted that you were able to join us today, Chris Smith.
Thank you very much for your time, guys.
It's www.valleyproduce.com.
Is
there a THE in front of it?
No.
No, just valleyproducecompany.com.
Valleyproducecompany.com. So look it up, track down these products. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. Chris, have a great day, and
have a great good day.
And send us an email to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
Absolutely.
So that we have your direct email contact. And we can make sure we get connected before we set off for Australia, so we can contact one another then.
Absolutely. I look forward to catching up with you guys.
Okay, Chris. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
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 And
it's time to take a break.
No kidding.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. I'm getting very excited.
Yeah, you are.
You are.
Well, I have a great adventure planned for us, but let's do the little housekeeping routine before we forget.
We send everybody to www.onthemenuradio.com to catch up with what's going on in the wide world of food, wine, and travel.
And if you want to send us email, you send that to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and we get your email. And if we like it, we accept it. If we don't like it, we ignore it. That's just the way it should be. As Anne mentioned, she's getting very excited about the fact that we have a trip down under planned, taking off next month. That's why we've been giving the program an Australian flavor. That's why we had Chris Smith from Valley Produce kicking off the program today. And last week we had Luke Mangan from Glass Brasserie.
And Australian Lamb.
Yeah, later in the program today, I think we're going to have
Brad Farmery.
Our old friend Brad Farmery.
Right.
With recipes for small plates from Australian lamb,
but
which sounds like
you know what
fun.
I think we ought to do, by the way, is explain. I don't know. Last time we went to Australia, it was 5 hours from here to Los Angeles, and then it was 15 hours from Los Angeles to Sydney.
Is it
any shorter a trip this time?
No, that hasn't changed because there's no Concorde available.
Wouldn't I love that?
Yeah, that would be nice. Anne always thought that was the right way to fly, and I think she's probably correct. Except, unfortunately, it's not in the air anymore. So what can you do?
The first time I flew Chicago to Melbourne, it was 22 hours.
Right, so it's gotten a little faster.
It's gotten a little better. letter.
Yeah, so this is a United Boeing 747, which takes about exactly the same length of time as a Qantas 747. The last time we flew, flying at about 550 knots, and
I wanted to fly Singapore.
It's a fairly long way, and we get there after losing a day, crossing the international dateline. We get there on a Saturday.
Explain that to me sometime.
I'll explain it to you as we cross the international dateline.
It's worse coming back when you get two Sundays.
Well, what happens is you arrive before you left, which is more than a lot of more than a lot of people can comprehend.
I can't cope with it. No.
So anyway, I'm just looking forward to sunshine because
it's summer there.
Yeah, we get to Sydney on a Saturday morning. And hopefully that night, or lunchtime or that evening, Luke Manger's going to cook for us at Glass Brasserie. He promised he would if he was in town, so we have some details on that still to be worked out. But that should be fun. And then on Sunday, we go to the just-named second member of the Relais Chateau chain, a place called Jonah's, which is about 45 miles north of Sydney, right on the coast. And we stay over there and we have dinner there. If I can really make it work on Sunday, we'll be going to this wonderful place called the Barara Waters Inn.
Yes.
But I'm in the process of negotiating with the chef about that to find out if it's feasible to do that, because it's only open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So Sunday gives us the opportunity to do that. Monday, more adventures in Sydney. Tuesday, likewise. And then Wednesday, we'll leave for Brisbane.
And then
from Brisbane, we go to see our friends at Brook Farm. You remember those guys?
The macadamia nut people.
Right. And then the day after that, with a old Pittsburgh connection.
Danny Mosdale, my favorite chef.
We're going to head to have dinner with Danny Mosdale and his wife Angela at their restaurant called Blue Angel in Noosa, which is about...
which is Surfer's Paradise.
No, it's not. It's north, not south. Surfer's Paradise is down in the Brook Farm direction.
You mean, Noosa, it's called Surfer's Paradise, but isn't there a lot of surfing there at Noosa?
Well, it's a beach resort, but I don't know how much surfing there is. Anyway, they have a great
restaurant. Australians are very serious about surfing.
So we'll catch up with those guys, and then from there we fly to Tasmania, where we visit our old friend, and actually my relative, owner of the Shaw Plant, which produces organic avocados.
Yeah, that's where we saw the real live in the wild duck-billed platypus last time.
Exactly. And during
waddling out of the woods into the pond.
During a few days there, we're going to try to find the truffle hunter.
Right.
Although I haven't closed loop on email with him yet, so that's still at a loose end. We're going to taste some wonderful Tasmanian sparkling wine, which is a lot like the sparkling wines from California. Can't be called champagne, but it isn't really wonderful stuff. And there's a Tamar Valley wine route that I think we're going to take.
Yeah.
And we're going to revisit our old friends, Remy and Jeanette, who used to own the place called Calstock that we stayed the last time we were there. And they now have a new place called the Glencoe Retreat.
Uh-huh.
So we're invited there sometime during our stay. And I'm sure we'll get up to a variety of other adventures before heading for Melbourne. So the 28th of February, we head for Melbourne. And Leap Year Day is the first day of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, which we'll be reporting on.
Yeah, does that really give us an extra day in Australia?
It actually does.
It's definitely a
bonus day.
Do they do Sadie Hawkins there?
I don't know the answer to that, but it happens to be the first day of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, and I think they're chasing another Guinness Book of World Records with an event called the Longest Lunch.
Longest Lunch?
World's Longest Lunch. I think it's on the Flemington Racetrack.
What's the record?
I don't know the answer.
Sounds terrible.
I don't have that one at my fingertips.
I hope it's not related to extreme eating,
there's going to be a variety of events over this few days. We're supposed to catch up with Michelle Rue from the Waterside Inn, who's going to be demonstrating how you make souffles.
Oh, he's going to be there.
He's supposed to be there. So there's all kinds of festivities, which we're still getting information about. And we're going to visit with our old friend Gail Donovan at Donovan's house in St. Kilda, and Philip Mouchel, who when we first met him was the chef at the Paul Bocuse restaurant in Melbourne. He now has his own place again in what's called the Crown Complex.
He cooks like an angel.
Yeah. Yes. He's cooking traditional French brasserie food, but using Australian ingredients. So that sounds like
that's,
it might be fun
I think
too.
That's an on trend.
Okay. Then we're back on the road again, headed for Chateau Yering. If you'll remember, our last guest, Chris Smith, was actually a chef at Chateau Yering about 9 years ago. It was the first relay chateau property in Australia, and we're going to stay over there. Then we're going to explore some Victorian wine country, a state, Victoria, which didn't produce any wine worth drinking when I lived there three decades ago, but it's now probably the hidden gem of Australian wines, and we're going to try to sample some of them.
Yeah, I mean, so I like the whites even. I'm a red wine person.
There'll be whites and reds, Pinots, Chardonnays, all kinds of wonderful stuff. Before we head off for the heart of the cradle, if you like, of Australian winemaking, South Australia.
Yeah.
And we have a visit there with Yolumba, which is now a big chain of, they own properties all over Australia, but the original Chateau Yolumba is in the Barossa Valley, and it's still owned by the Smith family, who founded the winery back in the 19th century. And we actually went there together, if you remember. We went to their building, which is like a castle.
Oh, right. Okay. That's when we got that tray that we still have.
Way back in 1973. So we're going to be following in some old footsteps, but finding out that there's been a tremendous change in the Australian wine business, all to the good since then.
And Adelaide. Adelaide has to be one of the friendliest places in Australia.
Yeah, I think we might just be in the Barossa Valley this time.
Okay.
We're saving days on our trip because we want to spend as much time as possible in Western Australia.
Which we've never been.
Yeah, we've only been in the airport. And so we have 8 days, I think, in Western Australia, including visiting the area around Perth and the river there, which is called the Swan River. And then we're headed for Great Southern and the Margaret River regions, which are great wine-producing areas, where there are also supposed to be great restaurants, too. And I'm waiting on our final itinerary for that part of the trip. And then, sadly, on the 16th of March, we get to fly to Melbourne and then fly all the way back home again and arrive before we left.
You forgot to mention how I'm madly in love with eucalyptus trees.
You'll get your fill of gum trees.
Yeah, and also marsupials. I'm a big maven of marsupials.
Probably might catch a few of those, too.
So does
that sound like fun?
It sounds like I'm so excited. I wish we were going now.
There's all kinds of additional things that are still sort of up in the air about where we might be able to go. But anyway, those are some of the highlights. So we're going around Australia in a collapsed circle, just because of the way things come together. But I think it'll be fun, and I can promise you that in the programs that run after we get back in late March and early April, you'll be able to OD on all the delights, and we'll be able to relive them again with you as well. That's the story. I think we're getting ready to take another break after this short segment discussing our whole trip, and when we come back, it should be our old friend Brad Farmery. So what are we going to do now?
We're going to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're going to jump a little bit to what I think is a very refreshing new take on what you drink.
Boy, you came back with some volume from the break, too.
I did.
You must have been refreshing your taste buds, washing out your thirst with product from our current guest.
It's called Dry Soda, and we have the founder and CEO on the line, Sherelle Klaus. Hello, Sherelle.
Hello, how are you?
Now, but tell our listeners how you came up with the idea for this wonderful, refreshing, new, we're calling it a modern beverage, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, the idea came to me when I was pregnant with my fourth child, and I was tired of...
Oh, Sherelle, how many do you have?
I have four.
Oh, all right.
dry soda nipped all that in the bud.
It absolutely did. I call it my fifth and final. I was really tired of going to restaurants with my husband and feeling very left out. It was very clear that I couldn't pair wine with food while I was pregnant, but I really wanted to be able to feel like I was pairing food, still having that experience. I looked around and realized there really was nothing for me in carbonated soft drinks, and I enjoy the fizz of carbonated soft drinks, but they're also the highest per capita beverage in the United States.
And growing.
So And actually, it's declining because there's been no innovation. People are getting tired of Pepsi and Coke, and we have a much more sophisticated palate than I think a lot of the big companies out there are recognizing. And I wanted to come up with what I thought our palates would like, you know, here in the United States in 2006 at the time, or 2005.
Well, so I mean, just to get everybody to understand, your flavors are not the run-of-the-mill flavors.
No, absolutely not. We wanted to use cuisine-inspired flavors that would really capture people's attention and give them something new and modern to try. So we have lavender, which is amazing with chocolate. We have lemongrass, which the idea there was food, so you could pair with Asian-style food, but it's just an amazing drink on its own. And then we had kumquat, which is a small citrus fruit, so it's not too unique in that it's still very much a citrusy, but it's just much less sweet. And then we have rhubarb, which I think rhubarb is such a complex fruit that it would make a very refreshing drink.
No, it's not made from the stems, is it?
From the leaves?
No, you mean the leaves.
It's not made from the leaves.
No, it's not made from the leaves,
that's,
I promise.
That's what Anne threatens to cook for me if I've been a bad boy. I suspect I'm being a bad boy right now.
Maybe I should keep a bottle of the stuff made with the leaves just for special guests.
But I mean, this idea came to you in a flash, but you didn't know anything about making soda, correct?
Absolutely. You're right. The idea came to me. I'm definitely an entrepreneur, and I look at holes, and I think any entrepreneur should do that, is look at holes in your experience. What are you passionate about, but what's missing in that experience?
Now, so did you really have anything prior to this as an entrepreneur?
Yes. I had an internet company in the late 90s called Planet Squid, which was a secured portal for 10 to 13-year-olds.
Oh, that's neat.
It was neat, but you know what? I'm not passionate about what 10 to 13-year-olds do on the internet. So I wanted to make sure that the next company I ever started would be something I was extremely passionate about. And there's nothing more than food and wine. And so it was a perfect fit. And then when I did some research and I really realized that, you know, carbonated soft drinks were declining. They were big. There was really time and room for a new category of beverage. And so that is absolutely what we believe we're doing here, is building a new category. And Dry is really the leader in that.
Now, have you run across Fizzy Lizzy at all? Lizzy from Fizzy Lizzy?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I've become good friends with Liz.
Oh, she's
had a long conversation yesterday.
Yeah, we interviewed her. Yeah,
she's so funny. When she was on the program, she said, "I didn't have the slightest idea what I was getting into."
You know, and her and I have, we just laughed and laughed yesterday about just, you know, our own, yeah, it's because the beverage business is very competitive and there's a lot to learn. And I didn't have a beverage background. I definitely have lots of employees now, though, that have beverage background. And I brought a board of directors that has a very good beverage background. We have the CEO of Red Bull and CEO of Red Hook. So we have, you know, I definitely brought some experienced people around. But yes, I had no experience, but I'm very passionate about it and wanted to move it forward.
Now you have another interesting ingredient in there that's not common in soft drinks in the U.S. as well, and that's the sweetening agent.
Sugar.
I'll let you say what it is. I want to let the secret out.
It's pure cane sugar. And if Dry is going to be really, for some people, a substitute for wine, others just a refreshing beverage, you need to make sure that this is all natural, that it is going to taste as good as possible and not have a funny aftertaste, or you want it to be as pure as possible. So we're using the pure cane sugar.
As opposed to the universal menacing high fructose corn syrup?
Absolutely.
That's in absolutely everything, including toothpaste.
Exactly.
Or Splenda. I mean, I've never tasted anything quite like that. You could taste it for 6 days later.
Yeah, we had this long discussion with a bartender in Healdsburg, California, about tonic water.
He said
the problem with tonic water made in the U.S. is that it's all made with a sweetener called either high fructose corn syrup, or if it's the diet variety, it's Splenda or something like that. And it's just the wrong thing because it's just way too sweet.
And he
turned us on to a product called Fever Tree. In fact, we've been trying to get samples of Fever Tree, but up until now, they're not cooperating. If Fever Tree is listening, would you please pay attention, guys, because we need a good source for tonic water.
Let me just do one quick plug. There's a new company out of Brooklyn called Q Tonic, and I met them yesterday at the show, and their stuff is amazing, and they use organic agave. So it is.
That's a hot new sweetener, blue agave syrup.
So that's cute.
Well, honestly, this was an incredible drink. I was pretty happy.
It's sweeter than sugar, actually, but you don't need to use as much of it.
Yeah, I don't, because it wasn't too sweet, and obviously I'm very picky about too sweet, so, but anyway.
Me too.
Now,
how do you spell that so we can follow up on that?
It's just Q, the letter Q.
Okay.
Q-Tonic, and they're out of Brooklyn.
Okay.
Well, we should be able to find them.
And one thing I'd like to note is that when you're looking for a modern beverage, as you did, you took in the whole look. I mean, you have your graphics, everything. Are those bubbles your logo?
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea there is, for me, is we're building a brand, and customers want a consistent, strong brand. And I have a great example of that in Seattle, which is Starbucks. You know, maybe not as much now, but their brand was so consistent, and I wanted that same deal with dry. So you will see from our bottles to our packaging, and those bottles have won 10 design awards.
They've
been featured in design magazines around the world. They were actually in the Modern Museum in Colorado for a while.
Beautiful.
It's really, we have a responsibility to make sure that that packaging and that branding is consistent through every single thing we do, website, the demos that we do, the sampling that we do, everything is consistent with that brand.
So you've created a category of soft drinks, but is the target market still the traditional people who drink soft drinks, like mostly children?
No, this is definitely much more geared towards, although children are drinking it, I think that it was definitely geared towards adults who are looking for the alternative. And so we have very fanatical customers who, we literally get emails every day. I have several of them on my inbox right now talking about how, thank you so much for creating something that's not too sweet, that's unique, that makes me feel more sophisticated. Because as we know, sometimes when you're at a party and you don't want to drink and you're walking around with a can of Coke, you don't feel very sophisticated.
And people come up and ask you if you're pregnant.
There's always that. And I'm tired of that question.
so you think the smart bottle is really it's a cocktail party conversation piece?
Absolutely. And dry was developed then, as we said, to pair with food. So dry is sold only into white tablecloth restaurants on the on-premise side with the restaurants. And it's actually served in a champagne flute in restaurants because we want to give people an event. They deserve an event, even if they're not drinking.
How do you control how it's served in a restaurant?
We do wait staff training. We do a lot of wait staff training because we'll also work with the restaurants to pair their menu with different dry sodas.
I see.
So you'll get flights of dry, or you can have dry interspersed. Throughout your flight of wine, we're in some great restaurants like the French Laundry. And
you're in the French Laundry. Well, that's,
we are in the French Laundry and restaurant Gary Danko and some.
Oh, I love Gary Danko.
I do.
He's a really dear friend.
Yeah.
Oh, his restaurant is amazing.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is, and they do a great job with dry there.
You have here a serving suggestion, which is more. It sounds more like a instructions on how to taste wine. I have a little card here that says,
oh, right.
One taste, no ice.
Yep.
Then aroma, no garnish.
Yeah, absolutely. We think it's important how you experience dry, too. We want this to be an experience for everybody. So we definitely suggest not pouring it over ice. Serve it chilled. Serve it in a nice piece of stemware. We've carbonated in the style of champagne, so it's really nice. Not that it's not just fun to grab a bottle of dry and down it, which I do all the time here at work, but it's also nice to make it an event. Sit down, pour it into a nice glass, have a piece of chocolate with the lavender, and we suggest not garnishing it because it has a very specific aroma and flavor.
And what about these special baskets you have?
Oh, yeah, the gift baskets. That's been an interesting situation. We have had more, especially even at the Fancy Food Show, more gift bask companies wanting to use dry soda because they want a beverage in there, but one that's really going to stand up to the beauty of their baskets. So we actually have developed our own for the holidays and actually throughout the year, and they're on our website, drysoda.com. But just a unique gift because, again, like I said, we have fanatical customers who love the brand, who love the packaging, and want to be able to give it in unique ways.
Yeah, I like this dry celebration bowl.
Isn't
everything needed for a celebration.
Yeah, that bowl is beautiful.
Screw pool, champagne bowl by Le Creuset, 8 bottles of dry soda, 8 stemless champagne flutes, 3 dilettante chocolates. I haven't tried those. I have to try those.
Oh, they're very good.
You were sitting in the hotbed of great chocolate in there in Seattle.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Cheryl,
I try to make friends with all of the chocolatiers here.
Oh, I would.
Now, are you getting much feedback from bartenders?
Absolutely. Restaurants was the bartender started grabbing it and using it as a mixer. So we've had to really embrace that usage of dry.
Oh, yeah. Have you had any really astonishing cocktails come out of it?
Oh, absolutely. And I hate to talk about this one because I don't have the ingredients for it yet, but the bartender sending it to me is there was a restaurant in called Addison in San Diego.
Oh, yes, I went there. It's a fabulous restaurant.
Is that not just the most amazing restaurant? Anyway, he made the best cocktail I've ever had with dry, and I've had some amazing ones. So I'm going to get him to send me the recipe, so we'll get that up on our website.
Oh, good. And let me know, because I'm doing an article for a summer issue of a quarterly on the new cocktail.
I will send you this one. And then we also have quite a few other recipes on our website as well from different bartenders around the country that have used dry and sent them in. So there's been some very
great
ones. And the other piece, too, is that they can help become all-natural cocktails are much lower in calories because dry is only 50 to 70 calories a
bottle. I was going to ask you, how many calories? 50 to 70, that's really good.
Yeah, for the whole bottle. So you're really looking at it's nice to have this all-natural, low-calorie
option. So as soon as this is over, I can go down and swing the rest of the bottle, huh?
You absolutely can, with no guilt whatsoever.
I don't know. There might be some guilt.
Oh, dear. Well, now, how do people get this?
So dry soda is sold in Wild Oats nationwide.
Okay.
And it's sold in Whole Foods and gourmet groceries and grocery stores in all of your states from the Rockies West, so Texas, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, Nevada, all of the states, California. And it's also available online.
And your website is?
And our website is www.drysoda.com.
Right, and that's, listeners, you go there to find out all these hot recipes for new cocktails, too.
And is there a store locator on there as well, Cheryl?
I'm sorry.
Is there a store locator that says,
yes, in my
zip code, where can I get?
Yep, absolutely. You go in there and there's a map and you can point to where you want to go and it'll tell you all the restaurants, hotels, and grocery stores in your area that carry it.
Great. Now, what's coming next? New flavors or new concept or what exactly?
Absolutely new flavors. We are looking at new flavors and we're working with some chefs to develop those new flavors for most likely they will be out early 2009.
Now, are you skipping this? Everything's coming out with Saya.
Oh, yeah. No, I will not be doing it. I will guarantee there will be no Aussie, no pomegranate. I promise you that. We will not do that. We definitely want to be on the cutting edge of flavors. We also want to see if we can't, bring more people to the table with some, maybe flavors that they've seen before, but not done in a dry way.
You know what? There's a guy we should put Cheryl in touch with. You remember the bartender at Cyrus in Healdsburg?
Oh, yeah, because
he's working. Well, no, I was thinking about new ideas for flavors because he's using all kinds of oddball botanicals.
Green things
that aren't fruits even.
Yeah,
oh, right,
herbs
absolutely.
And stuff.
Herb.
He has straws with little fork tips on them so you could spear all the things floating around in your drink.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
And then what was the other thing? Celery that's hollow in the center is used as straws.
Oh, funny, really?
I mean, there's a special species, or whatever you call it, of celery that comes hollow in the center and they serve as straws.
Yeah, I think Scott Beattie is the name
of
the bartender.
At Cyrus, huh?
But
Cyrus,
I have his email address somewhere, and I'll when I send a note to Abby that says, listen to the program, because it's going to be on the air such and such a date, whenever that is, I'll include that information. And in the meantime, if you just look up Cyrus, C-Y-R-U-S, restaurant in Healdsburg, look it up in the phone book, give him a call, tell Scott that On the Menu sent you, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to talk to you.
That would be excellent.
Okay, well, Cheryl, we're at that hook moment.
Oh, yeah. That's an in-joke that people don't know about.
I get to always play bad cop.
I say
yes. We've enjoyed talking to you enormously, and wish you the best. And we're enjoying the dry soda.
And we'll probably see you at the Fancy Food Show in New York in July.
Absolutely. I look forward to seeing you then.
It's June.
It's still July.
Starts June 29th, goes to July 1st.
Right.
So it's both.
Very excited for that one as well.
Well,
Cheryl, we know you just got back in the office. You must have 1,001 things to do. So thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day, and our best regards to everyone at Dry Soda.
Thank you. thank you so much, you guys. I look forward to seeing you in June.
Great.
And now it's,
now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we seem to have a lot of old friends on, not old meaning like that they're old, but people that we know and love. And we have another one on the line right now, Brad Farmery, chef extraordinaire.
Shall we do the good housekeeping before we do that, though?
You mean you're going to do the website and the email?
Don't forget that you can email us at any time at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and you can look at all the other resources we've assembled for you at www.onthemenuradio.com.
Exactly.
And Brad Farmer is on there once or twice already.
Yeah.
No, it's great to talk to you guys again.
Yeah. So, Brad, we're going to be talking about Australian lamb today because you're a great spokesperson for Australian and New Zealand products. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to
and wines too.
Yeah.
And wines. I mean, that's a product, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But we mustn't forget.
Right.
To highlight the fact that one of the things that Brad and Adam and co have done at
Public
and at the Mundy Room is to assemble vintages of Australian wines that you can't even buy in wine stores and vineyards in Australia because they snap them all up because they think the wines are so exciting. So that's just an aside.
I wanted to introduce the fact that actually Brad was the chef at Public.
Then go ahead.
In the Mundy Room.
Do it the right way then.
And while I'm at it, there's so much about him and his brother Adam and his design company Rocco that I wanted to point everybody to the website www.publicnyc.com, isn't it?
Yeah, public-nyc.com.
Oh, okay, so I missed it.
Watch out for
that hyphen.
For that hyphen.
Okay. Get you every time.
If you don't put a hyphen in your lamb recipe, it won't work.
Right. And let's talk a little bit about lamb. I mean, we were going to actually have this cooked so we could taste test it with you. It's Australian lamb that arrived this morning, but we didn't have time to cook it, and we thought, aha, this is a good opportunity to ask Brad how we should cook it.
Squeeze some secrets out of me, huh?
Yes.
We're going to try, but there's a theme underlying this, Brad, that you're a part of because of the way that you're cooking at Public and the Mundy Room. So why don't you introduce the concept for us?
Yeah, well, recently, especially we opened the Mundy Room about 1 year ago, and that's a wine bar that's adjacent to Public, and it's all a small plates concept and small plates menu there. Most of it paired with wine. And so we thought that we would take dishes and ingredients that are usually only used in main courses, like lamb, for instance, and try to make small dishes so that people could get a taste of it without having to pay $30 for a whole meal involving lamb. That way they can kind of dabble into different cuts and just get a bit of a flavor without being overwhelmed.
Yeah, this is very much the way that Anne likes to eat, and in fact Anne and Peter like to eat when we eat out. And we had so much fun, by the way, the last when we were at the Mundy Room with Adam.
Yeah,
and
that was fun.
And incidentally, the kitchen did a fabulous job without you because you were off you were off playing around or something.
Yeah, I think I was up cooking in Iceland, actually.
Well, that's like playing around.
Yeah.
But so this small plates are now. Small plates are not all ordinarily associated with lamb. I mean, the lamb that you get at the French Laundry, the lamb that you get at Per Se, from our good friend Keith Munt and Liz in Fields, mm-hmm. and the lamb that you get from wonderful purveyors in Colorado, is all, let's say, America's a big country and the lambs are big too. Mm-hmm. So there's something different here.
Yeah, the Australian lamb, so many people think that, local lamb especially is the way to go. And, they do great products and they have small farms and people who are really paying attention to the end result and watching over the product to make sure you get something great. But people also forget that small countries like Australia and New Zealand also have these same farms and that, you can meet passionate people who are selling a good product, that the same thing, they've put their heart and soul into it. And the end result as you said, is slightly smaller in size, I think, than a lot of the lamb that you get here. And also, you know, a slightly different flavor, you know. And that's why I like to offer people something different and let them make up their own mind.
Now, what's the difference in flavor, Brad?
That's a tough one to really put my finger on. You know, I can't say it's stronger or milder. It's just a slightly different flavor. You know, same thing with the fat content. You know, the fat content can change so much with the local lamb and the seasoned here, whereas a lot of times the imported Australian lamb, it's a little bit more consistent. At least from what I found, because also their temperatures are more consistent, their feeds and their...
So it's not like, I mean, here, lamb in the spring has some garlic in it because of the garlic grasses that come up. And
you really do get a grassy flavor in that spring lamb. And, you know, it's a good thing, and the different cycles are interesting, but, like, again, I've found Australian stuff to be very consistent, very delicious.
Well, let's throttle back here just a second, because you said something just a second ago that really isn't geographically terribly correct. You said Australia and New Zealand are small countries. Well, I have to suggest to you that Australia, in fact, is a very large country. It's a very large country with not a lot of people and a whole lot of lambs.
You're definitely correct there. It is, you know, about the size of America, and yet a lot less people. And as you said, the lamb outnumber the people.
But if we go back a step too, the original huge exporter of lamb from that part of the world was New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And with the market back in the mother country, which I used to live in at the time, but it all came frozen. That didn't mean it wasn't a tremendously valuable protein type product, and it was always very consistent. Mm-hmm. But it was frozen. You didn't get very much lamb from Australia. You got lamb in Australia when you lived there.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Haig, before she was Mrs. Haig, was a wonderful buyer of it. As we were talking off the air, listeners, I was letting Brad know that when Anne was in Australia 35 years ago, she bought lamb, and it was $3 for a whole side.
And half of a lamb.
And she used to go into the butcher shop with a little map. A
diagram.
Of how she wanted the lamb cut up into different pieces. Because there were only two of us eating it, so we wanted it packaged in small quantities. And all the butchers would somehow be busy. They would all be off doing something, smoking a cigarette or otherwise.
Running away.
Otherwise trying to look busy. So, because it really wasn't worth all the work of cutting a 13-pound side of lamb up into all the little pieces that she wanted for $3 in return.
I need Anne working for me.
now that the price, of course, is a whole lot higher, but Australia has made its way into the international market in fresh lamb, and I think that's the biggest difference, and that's what we have.
Yeah, no, we're told that the lamb actually was shipped fresh, and it ages in the process of traveling.
Yes, yeah.
And that's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, the way it's been explained to me is that, you know, you have about... once it's vacuum packed, you actually have about 8 weeks or 9 weeks where it's aging properly, and that's what you want when it's in that vacuum environment. It's unlike dry aging meat that happens completely differently. So that gives them the opportunity to ship it to you, and actually when it gets to you, it's in the best possible condition.
Okay, so it's sort of wet aging as opposed to dry aging.
Right.
What breed do we start off with? What's the most common breed?
Oh, that I actually don't know.
Well, I mean,
what color is it?
It's typical Australian lamb, it would be merino. And, what would happen is it would be mostly the surplus boys.
But the merino is for the wool, not for the meat.
It also produces lamb too. It also produces good meat when the lamb is young, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that they have specialized what you might call meat breeds, like the ones that are used here or the ones that are used in England and in other parts
of the world. Yeah, I mean, in England and Yorkshire, we were just there. There are all those black-faced lambs. I think that's a meat lamb.
It's part of the process of essentially culling the flock of lamb, because even if your end product is wool, you don't really need nearly as many boys.
Yeah.
girls are so much more productive because they can multiply themselves.
Yeah.
So how should we cook this? What are the best flavor combinations to cook with lamb?
Oh, we had some fun talking about lamb, didn't we?
Yeah.
I didn't realize I knew that much about it.
I think, whenever I taste lamb, I always think of, Mediterranean flavors, whether that's Northern Mediterranean for Spain and Italy. But I also like a lot of those Moroccan flavors.
I do, too.
I think they really, really go well with that nice lamb flavor, like saffron and orange zest, orange juice, cinnamon.
Zaatar.
Zaatar, yeah, exactly. Toasted almonds. Thyme. I love those flavors. And I think, again, they pick up on that lamb flavor and they work so well together. So
we've on the mint jelly, please. Dump that mint jelly.
Now, let's nail this down a little bit. We have a 1.5-pound rack of lamb, mm-hmm. probably about 8 or 9 ribs. So it's very small and delicate.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do with it?
If you, unfortunately, in this weather, you probably won't be grilling it.
We'll have to do it on the indoor grill.
Yeah,
it's just a little bit too cold to go outside.
Yeah, in Pittsburgh, I know how it works.
Yeah.
To be honest, I would grill it because I think that does a nice caramelization on the flesh and help crisp up any fat that may be on it, and gives it that extra flavor. But again, I would make sure you definitely don't overcook it, especially something small like that rack. I would keep rare to medium rare. Probably a medium rare would be most people's favorite.
No, that's where we would go. A little lighter than medium rare, probably.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that a good old American rack of lamb. Cooked outside on the grill always takes longer than you think.
Because
it's such a solid chunk of meat. So we're going to do what
like
we're going
meatloaf. Meatloaf so, takes yeah. an enormous so long so period of time
so,
to cook.
So we're going to oil it lightly, and then we're going to sprinkle it with.
Yeah, I think if you want to go out on a limb, sprinkle it with some cinnamon, some ground cinnamon.
Oh, lots, that's interesting.
We've got that cinnamon chili. Chili rub that we got from Crazy Dave DeWitt.
That would be beautiful.
Would that be good?
Yeah, that would be great. I'd sprinkle it with cinnamon chili, some black pepper, and nice like Maldon salt. And the Maldon salt will help it crisp up on the outside as well.
It wasn't where we got that rub, but that's all right.
Wasn't it?
No. Dave's Gourmet is where it came from.
Oh, it's a different Dave. I get them all confused. If they called Dave, they must be the same guy.
There's a Dave for every occasion.
Dave for every how's your mother-in-law doing?
Oh, she's great. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, I miss her. I used to have regular contact with her when she was in business.
Yeah, she actually just came in for dinner last night.
Say hello to her when you're talking to her.
I'll definitely do that.
She loves you.
Yeah.
This is the listeners. It's Rosemary Morris, who is retired. She was one of the best PR persons in New York.
Yeah.
Now, Brad, have you cooked in Australia, Brad?
I have. I did a little bit of cooking in Sydney about 2 years ago. Down on Kangaroo Island, of all places, just south of Adelaide.
Sure, I know exactly where that is.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun, and I would go back in a second. I love it down there.
Yeah, isn't it great, huh?
Beautiful. Well, we're sort of themed for that. One of the reasons why this program is on today, aside from the fact that the Australian lamb people were really keen for us to get involved with Brad and talk about their program, is because, of course, we're headed down under next month, and most likely we'll... You think we might have lamb while we're
there? I'm sure we will. But what I look forward to is the Sydney oysters and barramundi.
Yeah.
Now, Brad, I'm going to ask you, I hope it's not a secret. Mm-hmm. I understand that you and your brother's firm of Rocco are opening a new restaurant.
It's true.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, we just picked up the keys yesterday.
Wow.
So we're very excited. It's not too far away from Public, and we kind of very much looking forward to maybe late May, early June opening and continuing with trying to push boundaries and excite people and show them something new and different.
What's the theme?
Keep it up because we'll be keep up the pace because we'll be in New York twice in June.
Oh, good.
One, once at the end of the month, so that would be terrific.
Make sure I save you guys a seat.
Yeah, now, what kind of food are you going to cook?
We are looking at, it's still going to be international flavors, but we're probably going to be doing a lot of charcuterie and curing and smoking.
Oh, nice.
And,
yeah, that's one of the big trends, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's such a great feeling being able to use every part of an animal and not be wasteful, and actually using old techniques and kind of updating them and bringing them back to people so that they can enjoy them.
Apparently Daniel Ballou is just doing gangbusters business.
He's
near Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the theme that he's on.
Yeah, where to
and,
go there.
And will you be making your own?
Yes. Yeah, at Public we make our own bacon and we make pig head terrines and sausages and cured meat and cured wild boar. So we want to take that to another level, but that obviously won't be just the sole purpose. You know, we want to find unusual fish that are underused and underappreciated. Same thing, take it back, you know, roasted root vegetables and things like that. So wholesome, good cooking, instead of just using whatever's trendy and new and different, so.
That sounds good to me, Brad.
Yeah.
But you always do, so.
Thanks.
So, our best to you, brother.
Okay.
And I hope you enjoy your trip to New Zealand.
Oh, great.
It would be fun if we run into each other, but I think it's a big place, and we're probably not going to do that.
Well, he's going to meet a different country. Though,
that's true.
Thank you so much for joining us, and next time we see you, we'll give you a report on how the rack of lamb turned out.
Perfect. Well, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And does that just about wrap it up, this?
That might take us to the end of another program.
I'm
really
so.
Not sure. I don't think we have time for anything else. So, so listeners, we'll see you, as we always say, same time, same place, next week.
Yeah. Bye-bye.